Ice spread a song so you can sing along with a special guest or two.
Or two.
You like to sing and dance, and this podcast by chance explores musicals for you. Theme song, yeah.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Life's But a Song, a podcast likes to live in the land of musicals. I'm your host, John, and with me today, well, we're still doing John's picks, and it's Ariana Armand. Woo! So I'm hoping with today's picks, I'm making up for Aria.
Yes. This is so much better. I was mildly concerned because when I was like looking up like where to watch it, I was seeing like 1-star reviews and I'm like, oh no, oh no. And then, but then it was much better than that.
So today we're here to talk about the 1951. Should we call this a classic? Like, is it well known?
You know, I didn't know it existed until you mentioned it.
Well, it's The Tales of Hoffman. I had the DVD in my collection for eons, it feels like. I just never watched it until this morning, and we're doing great.
We are so on it today, my guys.
The screenplay, and I'm using that term very loosely, is by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. I'm assuming that's how you pronounce their last name. Music by Jacques Offenbach. The English libretto is by Dennis. Oh, I need my glasses. Hold on. I'm blind without my glasses. Dennis Arundel. And it was directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. And according to IMDb, a melancholy poet reflects on three women he loved and lost in the past: a mechanical performing doll, a Venetian courtesan, and the consumptive daughter of a celebrated composer. So really only two people are not dubbed in this whole movie.
Yes.
And you can tell.
Yes. I was dying. Okay, so first of all, Moira Shearer, goddess. Just like,
of course. Ugh. Yes.
But the Olympia was
so she barely lip synced that.
She like started, and then, well, I mean, look at the dancing they were having her do. Like, that is not,
of
that,
course,
I mean, that's intense. So I mean, I get why the lip syncing like fell off, but I was getting a kick out of that.
It's not that it fell off, it's just that she just didn't do it. She started.
There were a couple of spots where she did. Very beginning, but she did, and then all of a sudden it just stopped.
And then she's like, I'm going to do my ballet, everyone. Fuck off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, oh, look, we have the same water bottle, except mine's different colors.
Ooh. What? Yes. Stay hydrated, everyone. So I had a couple of theories with this. Uh-huh. So buckle up, kids. My first theory is that it feels like they cast Moira Shearer, who, if you don't know who that is, she's a ballet dancer famous for the movie The Red Shoes, which is where a lot of dancers got their inspiration to go on. It's based off of another fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen. Anderson. Yeah. Yes. So, famous ballet dancer in this opera movie. And so I was like, well, did they cast her? And we're like, let's now make it a ballet.
I think so, because I've only seen like the live broadcast of Tales of Hoffman from the Met.
Yeah.
Yeah, so have I. And it's been a while. I think it was like, you know, during COVID. And of course, I've like watched clips of Olympia all over the place, because that's something that I work on.
Do you sing it at 3 a.m. at Club Cumming?
I would.
Or is this at 1 a.m.?
No, I would sing this at any hour if I actually like finally learned the whole damn thing. It's like one of those things that's been like, I work on it and then I like go away from it and work on other things. And then like, oh, I should really get back to this. And
yeah.
Yeah. It's like one of those.
This is your Everest, it sounds like.
It kind of is, because it's so much coloratura. It's so much just,
it's know. So high.
Oh, the high is not a problem. I'm sorry. Have we met? Hi.
Well, what? Yes. But also, credit where credit's due. I honestly loved the voice actors then. Because
mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there was not a clunker in the whole group.
It honestly sounded like they recorded a stage production and then used that.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't have that kind of studio lifeless.
And like, I know that this is 1951, so technology is not the greatest. I loved Olympia's like demise moment.
Oh my God, yes.
it was so like, okay, this movie is weird because it is heavily theatrical and not cinematic at all. I feel like because they were like, we're going to dub, they could have gotten away with more. Like, okay. So I know it's like really difficult for to have one person play the three roles. It's been done, but it's like,
well, it used to be. I mean, that used to be how you did it.
Right. But like, and but people are now like, oh, let's get more names in a production, or like, oh, let's not kill our person after they do Olympia. But I feel like for this movie, they could have gotten away with having Moira Shearer play all the women.
Yeah, but I think partly because her focus is so balletic.
Or like get somebody to play all the, but that's what I mean. If they were going to, since they're going for the dubbing,
yeah,
why not celebrate the dubbing? And
because I wouldn't, because I definitely, I could see her doing the Julieta, but I think I would want somebody.
You want a singer for Antonia?
For Antonia, not so much that like a singer, but because I think they would want to, like they did with Olympia, they'd want to focus so much on her dance ability, and that just doesn't
because Antonia is the singer of the women,
and then
Julieta is the actor.
I mean, she was doing a lot of dancing too.
She was doing some but I mean like as in terms of like what the role is.
Yeah, she's the femme fatale.
So what did you think of the movie? Like
I liked it.
Yeah.
There were like a lot of, there's something about that era of filming, and especially filming musicals, that's just so vibrant.
Yeah. They were not afraid of color. This.
Right, and like even, and this, and I liked this because it was, for the most part, it was a from what I know and remember of the opera, it's a pretty straight adaptation.
They cut some things, and obviously it's in English, so that's different.
But they didn't do like what they do with a lot of the movie musicals, like you look at your like Kiss Me Kate and you know things like that are just like so off source material. You know, for Too Darn Hot and Kiss Me Kate being
so different,
and Ann Miller, you know, just like throwing her clothes, you know, that which is like not at all how that number takes place in the show. Everything that was left intact, everything that wasn't cut or is pretty much as written.
Yeah, the only thing that I think differs, but a lot of other opera houses do this as well, is the last two stories are interchangeable. But because this is a movie, they're making a definitive statement of saying that it's Olympia, then Julieta, then Antonia. Which, I mean, I like, because it feels like Antonia is the one that he actually like really loves.
It gives it gives a growth pattern for him. Like the first segment, he's like very, and it kind of, and I think it showed it in like that book thing.
Yeah, the
which I
interstitial.
liked that. I like that interstitial.
See, there's some times where it felt like a break. Like it was, it mm-hmm. broke the momentum for me at moments.
So to me, it's an act break.
It is, yes. I understand what they're doing and everything.
And I liked it. I liked it because it gave you a very basic idea of what was happening if you didn't know the opera. I mean, you just kind of like, these are the players in this segment and this is where they're at. So like it gave you kind of the idea that Hoffman has gone from like callow, inexperienced in number one to
now being a full-blown poet,
you know, it, like a whole person in the third segment, which I think is why you get the, you know, so like the first segment is him. I mean, he falls in love with a mechanical doll. Let's talk about what we're thinking with here, because
Where they went a very, like, I'm going to use modern language for this because they didn't have it at the time. It looked like they went with like AI, like Megan or Chucky, the recent Chucky, where in the same act, let's go with act.
Yeah.
Because I know it's technically a scene because it's a movie, but let's say act.
Let's say act.
The dancer ensemble, the marionettes are all like bizarre, and you see their doll that they are portraying and everything. Mm-hmm. And with Olympia, they went very natural.
Mm-hmm.
Very, like, her costume's a little weird, but like,
I love her costume.
No, I mean, like, in terms of, it's not human like.
Right.
It's not like they went to a store and bought that. They gave her a costume.
Yeah.
But there's nothing really doll-like about her. Like, they didn't give her any, like, porcelain makeup or, like a wig that looked, you know, super fake or something. Mm-hmm. So it was a little interesting that, like, I'm like, did they just make a sex doll? Is that what's happening here? Like, I'm used to the Met one where she's wearing, like, a pink wig or something.
Right. And, I mean, I do think, to, like, some extent, she has to look a little more realistic because he does fall in love with her.
Right, but I'm saying, like,
I
guess also they didn't have the makeup or the makeup technology to make it look like she had porcelain skin or some...
Right.
Just something a little more doll-like.
Yeah. But, I mean, she kind of just... looks like that. I mean, she's got that, you know, those big eyes and the
Maura Shearer. Yeah, she was.
Yeah,
she was. I mean, no wonder they cast her as this. And that, I know. Also, in the prologue, they changed it because it's supposed to be another opera that they're seeing, but instead they changed it to a ballet because I guess they were like, "Hey, Maura Shearer, you want to do a little more?
Yeah, we've got her. Let's utilize it."
Yeah. Yeah, we're getting off the hype of the red shoes and everything, so we may as well keep going with that. But I, so I'm not gonna lie, I may have been a little too distracted on my phone during this. So there's a couple of times I looked away and then I looked back and I was just like, "What is happening?"
Well, hopefully those were not times when I was looking away, so I can fill you in.
Well, no, I mean, like, you know, I turned around, I looked at my phone, and then I looked back, and all of a sudden, it's the dancers being the marionettes, and I was just like, "What the fuck am I?" So I also really love. I said this earlier, but I'm going to repeat it. I loved the deconstruction or the, what's the word I want to say?
Yeah, that's deconstruction. I'd say that's pretty accurate.
Because you clearly see, you know, the person in the black, you know, costume when they're like, "We're ripping her leg off" or something.
Right.
And I love that though, because I felt like they were just like, we're also embracing the fact that this is an opera, you know, it's on stage mm-hmm. and everything. So we're using a theatrical device. Also, CGI is not a thing right now. So,
right.
So then we get to Julieta, the courtesan, if you will. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have the DVD of this. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, on the DVD, there wasn't a way that I could hear with my subtitles. So there are some things that I'm just like, what's happening? Like,
yeah, I did not put my subtitles on, and I probably should have.
Yeah, it was a little hard to understand. The thing with opera in English, dear listener, and I'm pretty sure Ariana knows this, is that to me, it's a little difficult to understand what mm-hmm. they're saying.
Yeah.
Because you're prolonging sounds, vowels, and things like that. And I'm like, I lost count what we're saying because you said O for the last 15 seconds.
And not only that, but things being translated from a foreign language into English for opera often doesn't quite track, right?
Yeah.
So yes. What they're saying doesn't always make perfect sense because they've got to kind of get the gist of the idea of what the translation is, but make it fit musically. And sometimes it just doesn't quite. And so if you're not looking at super titles or closed captioning or whatever, it can be a little hard to follow, even though it's in English.
So then, okay. So did you hear why she had to steal his reflection?
No, I completely missed that part of the plot. I just kind of, I feel like the last two stories are based on Faust.
They're all based Faustian.
Although E.T.A. I know they Huffman. Are. I know, but the stories both feel like very Faustian.
Oh, yeah. Well, so,
yeah.
Okay, theory number two that I have.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Hold on, let me find the actor's name. So the antagonist mm-hmm. in all the stories, played by Leonid Massine. I'm really bad, so go with me with
all
this
good,
one.
All good.
He plays all the villains in every story. He's the mm-hmm. one that is trying to the devil, basically. If we're going Faustian, but to me, it felt like he was in love with Hoffman. And so in order to have Hoffman to himself, he has to destroy the women.
Okay.
And I noticed that, I know we were kind of talking about Antonia, but I want to jump to the ending mm-hmm. where it's him and he's wrapping his cape around each of mm-hmm. the women and he is doing some sort of mask reveal a la mm. Mission Impossible. Where he's ripping off all the faces that he plays that we clearly know it's him, but right. he's like, look at me. I'm not wearing this character's makeup right now. And I was like, so are we trying to say that Spallanzani, which I believe is like the first character he plays, mm-hmm. like the one part of the opera house, who's also trying to fuck with Hoffman, I feel like he's a little jealous and he really wants Hoffman, but like obviously this is 1800s Europe and they can't do that because don't say gay or whatever. That's where my brain went. I don't know if you like
that's definitely not where my brain went, but I am also not a gay man.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if this is something I made up or if this is something that's actually true, but that his character and Hoffman are actually like rivals.
So it's like Amadeus.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. But also, I like my theory too because it's out there and crazy and gay.
No, I mean, your theory works as well. Like I said, I didn't go there because I'm not a gay man. and I wasn't getting like sexual undercurrents. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just he has such a weird face. How do you say his name again?
Leonid.
He's got that Crispin Glover type weird.
That very gaunt, like you. This man plays nothing but villains because he's got that gaunt, sunken.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was looking him up. He was born in 1896, so potentially, potentially he could have been. I don't know if he was actually in any like silent films, but he has that like silent film villain, look to him. And then they, you know, in this they at least highlight it with the insane makeup,
very dramatic operatic makeup. Yeah.
Oh, he's also in The Red Shoes.
They just shifted the cast over.
he's a dancer. That's it. Yeah. So good for him. Clearly he's lip syncing as well. So the only two that are not lip syncing are Hoffman, which thank goodness that Robert Ronsville is our Hoffman, and he is fantastic throughout. Mm. I mean, yes, he is lip syncing to himself, but they didn't dub him with somebody else.
It's his voice.
And the other one is Ann Ayers, who played Antonia, which I never understand Antonia's story. Because I'm like, it's an opera.
She's a singer.
No, she's the singer.
Oh, Antonia. Yes, Antonia. Sorry.
I jumped to Antonia. Sorry.
Yeah.
Because.
No, and like that, I mean, and that story is like, he went, oh, Traviata, Faust, here we go.
but you're a singer who can't sing. Otherwise, you'll die.
Well, she's dying of consumption anyway. Like, oh, okay. And then, like, the doctor comes in, and the doctor is, like, very Mephistopheles.
Who is Leonid. Fuck, we're struggle busting this whole episode. It's going to be fine.
It's fine. We're having fun. Have fun. Just because we didn't watch it until the last second this morning. Come on.
It's fine. That's not how I watch things anymore. But he was having that. So what's interesting about this movie is that, and I think the show as well, is that there's magical realism. Obviously there is with Olympia.
Right.
But like through, at least in the movie, they sprinkled it throughout. So like in the Julieta act, there he's turning wax into diamonds or jewels, and that's supposed to be her payment or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Antonia's story, he's turning some room into a stage where, okay. So Antonia's story, her mom is dead, but her mom was, what did they call her?
She was a famous opera singer.
Well, they said composer, but I guess that's
the dad. No, her father was a composer.
Got it. Her mom is the singer. So do we think that the mom is actually there? Because there's a moment with the doctor who's talking to thin air, pretending that that's the mom.
I think there's a statue in the room that represents the mother. That's the mother's
energy. This is earlier, before earlier? Antonia's demise, where he's sitting on like a chaise lounge with, and he's talking to air, and the dad is there, and everyone else is hiding behind curtains.
Okay.
So I'm like, and that's also when we first hear the mom.
Right. So maybe he's like, again, going back to like this Faust Mephistopheles thing, he's got the mother's soul. Because there was something about the mother dying similarly.
Oh, see, and I
and the and the, and like the father didn't want the doctor coming in for the daughter, because when the father, when the doctor came in for the mother passed away. The mother died.
God damn it. So I missed all of that.
Okay, cool.
I was too busy, you know, scrolling Instagram or something. But it felt like,
what were you distracted scrolling Instagram?
I mean, I was also a little too sober watching this movie, I felt like. I'm not gonna lie. Because watching it, when in Olympia's act, when we go to the marionettes that are people, I was just like, awake enough for this.
And you notice he put up, so like he had those glasses. It's the glasses change his reality and change his perception. And that's why you see.
Got it. I thought it was just I didn't realize it was in universe. I thought it was for us, the audience, where they're like, well, we could have dancing puppets a la what's going to come in The Sound of Music almost 15 years later.
Right.
But instead, we're going to make it people to save some money and time. And this way we can be like, choreograph people. Don't worry about the marionettes, the actual puppets. I thought it was more like a technical thing, in other words.
No, it's actually, he gets those glasses because that changes his perception of the reality, and that makes the marionettes appear as living people.
Talk about the eyewear in this, by the way.
Yeah.
I am obsessed with all the glasses that appear. Even like the most boring one. Like one of the villains is not as extravagant as the other glasses, but it's still gorgeous looking. Like I don't know if he has a name in the beginning. Is it Spallanzani in the prologue?
Wait, I feel like I need to look at IMDb. Yeah, it's Spallanzani. He's listed first as Spallanzani.
Yeah, okay. So if that is the actual, like, one in the bookend prologue epilogue, he has amazing glasses that he is on a stick that I almost fell out of my chair while watching.
Right.
I was like, I need these. I don't care if they don't fit my style or face. I just need them. I should talk to Mark Benani to see if he may have gotten them in an auction somewhere or something.
I just like pulled up
his IMDb.
He choreographed a whole ton of stuff.
Yeah. So like it says that he was the original dancer in the red shoes. Like, I guess it's a show as well. I've never seen it, so I don't know.
I saw it at City Center.
So it is a show. Okay.
Yeah, but I don't think it was prior to the film.
No,
I'm pretty sure the City Center production I saw was an adaptation of the film, but it was a ballet. It was straight ballet.
I'm seeing on his IMDb page for The Red Shoes that the part of the shoemaker created and danced by his name.
In the film, The Red Shoes.
Oh, in the film. Got it.
Yeah.
So that's like him, them saying he choreographed the shoemaker dance. Got it. Okay. I'm understanding now. I'm surprised though that they didn't have him really. I mean, he still held himself as a dancer now that I'm thinking about, like, thinking back to the last 2 hours of watching this movie. But like, I'm surprised they didn't have him dance more in this.
I don't think the focus was on him as a dancer, though. I think he was more of an actor in this.
But still, I mean, like,
because he was again, like you know, they had, yeah, but
they
he was,
offered
you know,
Maura Shearer more to do, and they changed an entire. Yeah.
Well, was he also doing the dancing in that beginning ballet with Maura?
That's him.
Understandable now. I get it.
Because they're doing this, they are doing a Faustian ballet that has
bug ballet.
The what?
It's a bug ballet.
A bug ballet.
No, because you know, he was like a moth or something, and she was like on the lily pads, and she had little butterfly things on her face. I think it was like the moth and the butterfly. I think.
Oh, see, I didn't get the bug references. I just saw his horns and I was like, oh, he's the devil. Got it.
No, I think it was supposed to be a moth.
Okay. Again, I was half awake and wait and
And not
not
drunk enough, and too
sober.
sober.
Too sober for this one. Oh, so Julieta, the courtesan. So, okay. Antonia dies because she sang. Olympia dies because of
Jealousy.
jealousy and everyone wanting to like, and they are ripping her apart and everything.
There was something about selling her.
Yeah,
And I
one
guess
of
the
the
check didn't clear. I think that's what happened. And I think there were ownership issues.
But like with Julieta, I may have blanked. Does she have a demise?
No, I think
Besides
she just
being
kind of
like,
walks away at the end. She just kind of like walks over like these Pompeii ash bodies.
yeah. Is it just like now you are forever cursed to like
But it didn't look like she was cursed. It also looked like, because she went from like the first segment is like she's in black and she's dark, and then at the end she's like in this white, like
so maybe she is dead?
flowing. So maybe that's just, we're talking a lot of imagery and,
And we're not on the
I think
drugs that they're
she's been
on.
I think she's been freed from having her soul held by the villain character in that segment.
Okay. Yeah, because she gave back his reflection. Right?
I don't know. Yeah, well, he gets his reflection back.
He
He
gets his
breaks the
reflection back.
mirror and the reflection comes back.
It's very Tommy.
It's very
It's
something.
very something. I mean,
What
honestly.
were these people on when they were writing this?
Well, so was
And I don't mean the movie people. I mean the
oh, so
book.
Jacques
I mean,
Offenbach, you mean?
yeah, I mean the original book writer.
Well, unfortunately, we have to go back like 2.5 centuries to
Yes.
ask him said question
I
because
know. I need to talk to these librettists.
I'm on the Wikipedia page for it. The premiere happened in 1881, and it has the whole cast here that I don't know any of these people. So I and they're all French names. So we know I'm doing great with French names today.
Yes.
Is this an opera that's done a lot? Do you know?
It is. They did it last season, I
But I mean,
forgot.
like
Or
around the
this.
world, not
No,
'cause I know the
it's
Met
yeah.
does.
No, when I was in Italy last year, they were doing it at La Scala and I really wanted to go and I didn't get to. Yeah, no, it's a very popular
Okay.
opera. I guess it's technically an operetta.
It is?
Yeah.
How so?
Offenbach stuff is considered more operetta
Well, so
because
I mean, I
it's
know
kind of
that.
it's like lighter fare. It's not quite as heavy
Oh, so we're
as,
talking operetta, not in the sense that there's actual spoken
right,
dialogue.
not in the sense of like Gilbert and Sullivan,
Okay.
but like somebody, because yeah, they did Orfeo and Eurydice at the Met recently, and there was like all this chatter online and stuff about what, I mean, it's really an operetta, so because opera snobs, fuck you.
But I feel like this is a good opera for those that have not seen opera. I feel like because you have it's a lot of fun. You get a little magic, you get a
Yeah.
whole lot of singing, and you and what and what's fascinating is that you have the coloratura Olympia. You have and then it feels like Julieta and Antonia are other forms of sopranos. I just don't know what
Oh,
terms because I'm a
yeah,
dum-dum.
Julieta is a mezzo.
The mezzo?
Yeah, or I don't know, I'm not sh yeah, a mezzo. I'm not sure about Antonia.
Antonia is just, pretty
Yeah,
lyrical
maybe, yeah,
voice.
lyric spinto something in there.
What's a lyric spinto?
No, I mean, she's like either a lyric or a spinto or
What's a
something like
spinto?
spinto. It's like a light.
Teach us. Teach the children.
Teach the children. It's like, I have to like actually look up specific definitions here. It's like a lighter soprano. It's usually kind of like a younger character.
Okay.
Yeah.
But not necessarily a younger performer.
No, it's a voice type.
Got it.
Spinto soprano is a type of operatic soprano voice that has the limpidity and easy high notes of a lyric soprano, yet can be pushed on to achieve. It doesn't, won't let me click on it. Wikipedia! Why do you hate me? Limpidity, easy high notes, dramatic climaxes without strain. And it may possess a darker timbre than the average lyric.
Okay.
But I always think of it as like kind of talking about like younger type characters, but maybe I'm...
I mean, that kind of would go with this, with at least this character, because she's supposed to...
Yeah.
It's interesting because, I mean, I don't know how old these people are supposed to be. It always feels like, though, that Hoffman comes in and is like, where's my woman? Where's right. the name well, of like, this
Hoffman
act?
Hoffman is a student in the first segment.
Yeah, so he could be teenager right. to young adult.
Right.
To 25.
Yeah, so I like picture him around like 18 to 21. At the beginning, and you know why he falls in love with a mechanical doll,
and then because the next two acts are interchangeable, it does, because I feel like Olympia is always first.
Yes,
and then like we said, or like I said, Antonia is like his actual true love, like his soulmate,
right?
The one. So it's fascinating to like. Think about it in a timeline where mm-hmm. he starts as a student and then the next act is inevitably when he's older, so he's later right. 20s, mid to late 20s.
Yeah, and I feel like that segment has to be the Julieta segment because I've always felt like an orgy to me.
Okay.
It's always kind of, I mean, she's supposed to be a courtesan, so And there's all these people around, and there's all it always kind of gave me like orgy vibes. So to me, that's like the second. So it's like the first segment is like innocent love, you know, like
innocent,
like,
yeah,
yeah, like
and then
innocent.
And then he's in
and
his slut era.
The middle segment is like exploring things, mm-hmm. and then the last segment is actual love.
Got it. Yeah, but then obviously he loses all three of them,
and he loses all three of them because. Because Leonid has something after is some kind
well, that's
of
the actor. That's
vendetta.
Not the character.
I know, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I just like saying Leonid.
Leonid has all of it. So, okay. You talked about how you're still learning.
The doll song.
You're mastering the doll song. So if you were... though to do a production of this, would you only do Olympia or would you want to do all three or like any combination of the two?
I don't think I'm vocally in Antonia. I could do it. I'd want to do all three or at least want to do Olympia and Antonia. I meant Julieta, not Antonia vocally.
yeah, because Julieta you said is the mezzo and you're more
yeah,
of
she's
up
like
there
a more
soprano.
Of she's a little heavier voice, but yeah, I think either I could do either Olympia or Antonia or both.
Okay. I would love to see you do all three though. As like a
challenge. Love to do all three because I mean just mainly because it's not really done anymore. I mean, Beverly Sills did it. You know, I think she was
And when was that like year
yeah,
like a decade ago or
back
more?
In the 60s, 70s.
Oh, more than a decade ago.
Yeah,
got
more
it.
Than a decade ago. She's,
but
she's
I feel
dead.
Like the more modern thing is to the two that you want.
I think the more modern thing is I can't remember the last time I've seen a production past.
I feel like I heard about a production where that was the big selling point, but I don't remember because that was pre-pandemic and you know we had a hard reset in 2020. So
right. Then we don't know. We don't remember anything before that. But yeah, no, I don't think I've really seen it cast in recent memory with all three roles being played by one performer.
Interesting. Oh, and I also thought, by the way, in this, I don't know the character name, so don't bother asking me.
I don't know character names.
Yeah. The pants roll.
Yeah.
I also thought that maybe that character was in love with Hoffman, because there's some longing glances that happen.
And
this is not me being a gay man in the moment, because that's definitely a woman. So
I feel like there's always kind of like, anytime there's a pants role that's interacting significantly with the male lead, there's I think there's always some kind of
sexual tension,
flirtation.
Yeah.
And maybe that was a way at the time to get the homosexual vibe out there without actually being homosexual, since it was a cross-dressing role.
And historically speaking, 1880s, like, it was that whole, like, gays exist, we just don't talk about it.
Yeah, we don't talk about it, and depending on where you are, it's still punishable by death.
Mm-hmm. But also, like, if you're in the arts, strong chance.
Yes, if you're in the arts, we know you're probably a little swishy, but we're going to let it go, because you get special dispensation in the arts. Just, you know, don't be too obvious about it.
So, at least with this movie, does it feel like they're saying that the opera can be turned into a ballet?
I don't know if they're saying that so much as they're just saying
they're just doing it because
they can have a ballet section. I mean, because there was a period in history where operas had ballets just like randomly in the middle.
Right.
Yeah. But it does, like, obviously, like, Cassie Morishira makes sense, and it works for Olympia, you know.
Yeah.
because of the physicality of the role.
And then obviously they use the bookends instead of doing, is it Don Giovanni that I think they're supposed to be doing? They're supposed to be doing another opera.
Yeah.
Like, that's the bookend scenes. At least then we get a little more dance and everything. And honestly, I did love that moment where the three women turned into the solo dancer, who's mm-hmm. also Moira Shearer. But like, right. And like, honestly, because the, because it's the 1950s and technology isn't great and it looked a little grainy and everything, I thought Moira Shearer at the end played all three of them, especially when they're doing that one like pose on the floor mm-hmm. with their leg up and everything. I was like, you got, that's a dancer move. Like, you can't fake that. So yeah. Unless the other two are dancers, I feel like you just threw their costumes on to Moira Shearer.
Right. I think that Julieta was a dancer, because she did a lot. She was very, she moved very.
I'm not even going to try to pronounce this person's
dancery.
Name.
I'm not. Yeah. She seemed to have a dance.
She also was in the red shoes.
She's a dancer.
Yeah.
She's a dancer. Yeah. Because the red shoes was all dancers.
Yeah. Let's see if Anne Ayers was in the red shoes as well. Why not? I'm not seeing it. So she's the only one that's not in the red shoes.
Yeah. So if they were in the red shoes, they were brought over from the red shoes as a dancer.
Yeah. Did Michael Powell and Emmerich do that? Yeah, they did. They totally did.
The dancers.
Michael Powell at least did the red shoes. Let's see if Emmerich Pressburger did. Oh, bated breath, everyone. Yeah, he wrote it. He was the writer for that. Was he also the director? Yep, he also directed it.
Okay, so they were just like, oh, look, we have all these fabulous dancers. What else can we do? Let's do an opera and dub them.
And there was one moment with Julieta that she turns her head away from camera, and you can tell she's not doing anything.
She's like, yeah, she's not doing anything.
It's It's like Valentina in Drag Race. I'd like to keep it on with
I'd
the
like
mask.
To keep it on, please.
Like she blatantly turns her head and is like, I did not memorize any of this.
I have no idea what these lyrics are. And when you do see her lip syncing, it's definitely not whatever it's supposed to be.
Although I loved that she was in tights.
Yes.
You know, we saw her legs.
Yes.
And I don't, I hope it's because they were like, well, she's a courtesan. So like, let's make her a little sexier. Let's like not have her in a dress because fuck conventions for women, you know? I mean, even in the '50s, it was like women wore.
Yeah.
Everything.
No, so. I think they were highlighting the fact that she was a dancer. Yeah.
Well, and I think also they were like, she's a whore.
She's a whore.
So of course she's not gonna wear all the clothes.
Wait, get her out of the
way. What was that? You cut out a little bit.
I said we need something we can get her out of quickly.
just do a kick and
just
we
kick it up
see
there,
the,
and there we go.
And we understand what you're doing.
Hello.
I mean, all in all, this is a pretty enjoyable film. I think mm-hmm. I just wasn't in the right headspace for this, personally. Yeah. Is there anything else, though, you want to talk about before we get into Sharp and Flat? I feel like we're missing a lot.
I feel like we're missing a lot. I feel like, well, and like for me, too, part of what had me having a hard time focusing on it is the only place I could find it had ads.
I'm sorry. I should have been like, I have the DVD. Let's figure out a drop off or something.
Like, yeah, drop off or a watch party. So I was definitely taken out of it because I was like watching it. I was like, oh great. And then of course they never put ads in any logical place.
Of course not. Yeah. No. So it's
like I don't know what's
in the middle
anymore.
of the doll aria.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
at least they
didn't do that. At least it wasn't like in the middle of an aria anywhere, which would have been really.
Oh,
shitty.
That would have been bad if you're
about
to get to
on
the
YouTube.
Note. You get to the high note, and then they're like, "Ad."
And
yeah.
Have you washed your clothes and Tide today? There were a lot of Tide commercials.
Jesus Christ. All, before we get to Sharp and Flat, though, am I now finally forgiven for Aria?
You are forgiven for Aria.
Thank you. Okay. I wanted to make... Well, because
I
was like...
I say that now until he pulls something else at me.
Because I wanted to make up because, you know, like I said, my mindset was Aria, opera, Ariana...
No, I mean, it made sense.
Three A's.
Like, it made perfect sense.
So now it's Tales of Hoffman. Ariana with this whole month it's like, am I torturing you or are you gonna enjoy it? What's gonna happen?
I mean, but even like the torturing side of things is kind of fun because we can rip it apart.
Yeah, this one was this one had some questionable things, but it was still like,
no, I don't know that I really have flats for this.
I have a few.
And when you say them, I'll probably be like, yes, I agree.
Yeah. So let's get into Sharp and Flat, shall we?
Yes.
But before we get into Sharp and Flat, I wanted to talk more about the opera. And I reached out to resident bestie Lauren Gismondi, who, have you done a production of it or multiple productions?
I have assistant directed the opera twice.
Whoa. So yeah. You know a lot about the show itself.
Yeah.
So Ariana, I think, was just letting me spout my random theories I had. And I wanted to run some of them by you and also ask you some questions about the show itself, because the movie, which you haven't seen yet, the movie is more dance based.
Okay.
And the show is not really like a dancing opera, right?
There are moments where you can have dancing. I think I remember, I mean, the opening and the closing in the bar, they were kind of raucousy, like bar dance. Does that make sense? You know, there was like people chicken fighting in the corner and stuff.
Yes.
the other scene, I remember choreographing a waltz for was, and if you hear a puppy, that's Finzi. He is the composer's dog that I'm currently staying with while I work on a musical right now.
So oh, God.
Under the table is because he wants me to play with him and not do my job. But the other scene I remember choreographing a waltz for was for Olympia, like at the science expo.
Ah, yes.
You had people coming through and waltzing and stuff like that.
So one of my wild and crazy theories is that, okay, before we get into the theory, I need to ask you about Spallanzani. So that track is the antagonist track of the show, correct?
Throughout the whole opera, yes.
Yes. So
Spallanzani is a Hoffman's adversary from jump.
So is it that Hoffman is envisioning his nemesis as the antagonist in every story?
Exactly. He's always thwarting.
Okay, so I had a theory that Spallanzani is actually in love with Hoffman.
Interesting. Could absolutely work.
So that, but like, that's never mentioned in the libretto or anything.
No. Spallanzani is jealous of Hoffman. And the fact that he, while being, you know, an inebriate and kind of a jerk, is beloved by, you know, everyone. And he has the most beautiful woman in their entire town, this very beautiful opera singer that he's courting right now. So basically, the whole opera is Spallanzani trying to get to Hoffman's girl.
Well, and that's where I was like, oh, hey, what if it's that Spallanzani wants Hoffman and is taking out the competition?
It's possible. It's very possible. Because the thing is, the opera has two endings. So depending on the production, you can kind of choose your own ending.
Well, so I knew that it's always prologue, Olympia, and then Julieta, and who's the other one?
You can figure it out. You can do it.
Nope, I'm not figuring it out.
Antonia.
Yeah.
Olympia, Giulietta, because Giulietta's Italian, and then Giulietta. Antonia.
So, but Giulietta and Antonia's acts can flip-flop.
They can flip-flop, yes. And the actor, or the singer who plays Niklaus, sometimes has this beautiful aria in the opera called the violin aria. It's gorgeous. And usually if a director chooses to include that aria, it usually means that the ending is, it features Niklaus becomes the muse, like the embodiment of Hoffman's actual real love.
So, okay, because I had another theory that Niklaus is also in love with Hoffman.
1,000%. Niklaus Hoffman.
So then what is this other ending that you're talking about?
Sometimes at the end of the opera, they will end it where where Spallanzani gets the girl and they run off together. And it just leaves Hoffman just lying in a drunken stupor and then curtain down, right?
Okay.
Version is that all that happens, and then there's the epilogue, which is when Niklaus transforms into the muse and is like, I have always been with you. I've never once left you. It is I that loves you. And then she leaves, and then he wakes up and he starts writing these stories that he's only been like sharing through word of mouth.
That is so cool.
Yeah. So when we did it at Dear Old Fredonia in 2010, that's the way we ended it, that way. So that he sang that last bit that he sings. I think he sings it to Giulietta. Like that part that he sings to her, we added it to, it gets added to the epilogue. And it's the last thing that you hear is, and then him, you know, like starting to write the stories.
Okay, so, okay. Now, question. I have a feeling that the three women that we follow are metaphors. Ariana and I had a whole discussion about that, but is there something in the text or in, like, the libretto itself that says exactly what they represent?
Three women in one.
No, but I mean, like, the way that we see it in the movie, and I'm not sure if the show is the same, is, like, Hoffman is going on a journey as well through like young adulthood to adulthood. And so like the doll represents early love, and we said that Julieta represents like his slut era because she's a courtesan, and then Olympia, I believe, is his actual true love.
You mean Antonia?
Antonia, excuse me. Antonia is his actual true love. But is there something that is definitively said in the text about these women?
Essentially, if I'm remembering correctly, it's what you're actually about. You all are describing it quite well. I think the biggest difference is when it is that it depends on the order you do it in. So that when I've done it, we've done it Olympia, Antonia, and then Julieta. Because basically due to heartbreak of Antonia dying, he is driven to go and start, you know, fucking around. And he's drunk and he's sad and he's all of those things. So he's very easy to manipulate. Okay. And that's when he sings Senti di amor. So I guess my other question is this the movie in English or in French?
Oh, it's so in English.
That helps me because honestly, I think things do get lost in translation, but essentially the doll is supposed to be like a plaything and she's perfect. Okay. She's physically perfect, but she has no real feelings, no real, you know, mental capacity or anything like that. Because when she sings, she's just singing, you know, what she's been programmed to sing, right?
Oh, interesting.
Think of it that way. Because that's the wind-up doll, the toy. So there's that. Antonia represents the tragic love. It's love that is doomed, that may be true and real, but that is also doomed to fail.
Okay.
She's too much, her heart gives out. Welcome to opera, I guess. And then Julieta is... Well, yeah, she's the tramp. But she also, out of all of these women, the showcase, is the only one that's really, for the most part, independent, you know?
So it's fascinating, though, that, like, the movie is making a definitive statement with the three women. Mm-hmm. But depending on the production, it changes the vibe.
Correct.
Okay. So in the movie...
Sure.
In the movie, there's some magical realism that happens. And obviously, with Olympia is being magical realism because the doll talking. But, like, is there more of that represented in the show? Or do you think that they just wrote it into the movie because they're doing a movie?
No, I definitely think that Olympia is the most fantastical. And I am going to say Olympia because that's the way they sing it. Olympia. So
I'm sorry.
I'm going to say Olympia. I apologize. I sound pretentious and I guess I am, right?
Well, you've done it twice, so.
I will always say Othello. I will never say Othello. Like, nonsense. But I would say the doll act is the most fantastical. I will say I was lucky enough to stage, actually Fredonia, they pretty much let myself and Mary Ryan do whatever we wanted. Because the stage director was kind of just like, I don't know how to talk to opera singers. And we were like, we probably do. So for Antonia's act, we created like this marionette puppet thing where the villain was the one controlling her mother. The ghost of her mother, who was in turn controlling and possessing her to sing during the end of it. And we had them do mirroring exercises. And so we were on a massive stage in like a 3,000 plus seat house. So we had all of them doing the exact same puppetry motions. And it looked like from the viewer's point of view, that the villain was the one literally controlling the downfall of Antonia.
You need to watch the movie. Because that happens with Olympia.
Oh, with Olympia. Okay,
but
cool.
Not with her, with the ensemble. Just watch it. You'll love it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because I feel like Hoffman, like so many of the other works written by...
Offenbach?
Offenbach. And also Hoffman himself. I mean, Hoffman wrote The Nutcracker.
Yes.
So many of these stories are like open to interpretation. They're open to kind of like, you can hear it and see it and you can take the stories in whatever direction you want. The fact that you can take songs out of it and it still makes sense. You can put it back in and it also makes sense. The fact that you can reorder the acts. In a way, it's kind of, I think it's such a freedom of expression, which I don't think always comes across in opera. So you can kind of do whatever you want with it. Like, I've seen productions of it where Olympia is, do you remember those like Gigapet looking dolls? They turned her into like a space doll.
Yeah.
And so she was like hopping around. So she was in like a harness and they were like, she was like flying over the audience while singing that crazy friggin' aria.
I mean, Ariana and I talked about the Met production a lot because we've both seen that. So, and I'm sure you've seen it too.
That one too. Because I took my mom to see that one. My mom really liked it.
Yeah. But it, so with Giulietta's act, at least in the movie, I can't speak for the show because it's been a minute since I've seen it, but she was tasked by the villain of that, the Spallanzani's character in that scene, to steal Hoffman's reflection.
Yes.
So I guess that's still part of the magical realism.
Yeah, essentially. I'll free you. You'll get this diamond necklace. That was what it was. That's what the whole thing about the diamond necklace, at least in the opera, comes into be, is he tempts her with this gorgeous, literally, yes,
that's right.
The song in the opera is Senti Diamant, which I was talking about earlier, and where he possesses the diamonds to entice her. And because, so she's on his, okay, so she's not nearly as free as I remember. She's on his leash as well. Right. I like the concept of, if I were to do it again now, I would make Spallanzani the ultimate puppet master the whole time. Ooh. And everybody is just at his friggin' mercy, the entire opera. And I mean, there have been points in time where like one singer would do all of the women. She would be all four.
I was just about to ask you about, wait, four?
I mean, yeah, because at the very end, his girlfriend walks in as herself.
Oh, the Spallanzani girlfriend.
Yeah, the one Spallanzani steals. I forget her name. It's like Christina or something. I forget.
Yeah, because we were talking about that. Mm-hmm. Because it's fascinating that this is a movie where they're dubbed, but they could have easily done that. But they didn't. They had three different women playing the mm-hmm. loves.
And that's fine. That's typically what's done. And it really is because, I mean, from a musical standpoint, those scores are so, it's written for like three different skill sets.
Yes.
So it's very, very difficult to find someone who can, in fact, sing all three. And that's no shade to anybody. Like, Offenbach purposefully wrote it to be difficult.
Really?
Yeah, I would say so. It's sort of like Queen of the Night, where like Mozart wrote it for the only one and only soprano who could do Queen of the sing those notes in the magic flute that was in Vienna at the time.
Wow.
Crazy stuff, because you have to think about it. These composers were writing for specific singers.
That's true.
We see it today in Broadway on a fairly regular basis. I mean, we've heard stories about, I think you and I have talked about, like Beth Leavell in The Prom, how they essentially wrote that right. character. With her, literally with her vocal range in mind, what her capabilities were.
And we've covered A Chorus Line, literally. So the Antonia and Giulietta stories, are they like, according to libretto or your memory of the libretto, are they based off of Faust?
A little bit. I definitely think there's elements of that story in this story. I don't want to say it's ripped page for page, character for character, but there are definitely enough similarities that somebody could go, huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because Ariana picked up on that. I'm the total dum-dum that did not. So I'm intrigued now to want to read the fairy tales or whatever you classify
these stories. Thing.
Yeah, of Hoffman, because
for children.
What?
I said fairy tale sort of is indicative that it's something that could be meant for children. This ain't that.
What do you mean?
Read the original Grimm's fairy tales. It's like, wait, I'm sorry, what?
So we were also confused, and maybe you can help us out with this. Do you know how old Hoffman is supposed to be in the show?
I mean, we cast him both times I did it. It was a singer in their 30s. So we wanted to stay kind of close to like late 20s, early 30s. Because I mean, if you think about it, that period of time in, you know, France, people weren't living that long. So he probably really would have been younger. But if you want to get somebody who can sing it, it's harder to find a 20-year-old, you know, who can handle that role, right?
Well, of course. So
I do believe he is supposed to be in his early 20s. In my imagination, he's in his early 20s, but often it gets cast older.
And obviously, because these three stories are supposed to take place over time, he's getting older.
Yeah, that's why I mean, not more than a span of a couple of years. I don't think it's like decades go by. I think at the most, maybe a few years, personally.
Like five, max? Yeah,
at the most, yeah.
So is there like a fun fact from the show that you want to share with everyone that you're like, this is something that nobody really knows, but we should be talking about it more?
Let me think. I think, I mean, we already sort of talked about how it can be jigsawed, different actors playing different parts and things like that. I think that this isn't really a fun fact, but this is something that I find intriguing, is the idea of Spallanzani being played by different singers.
Oh.
Where it's almost like that one version of the character passes on the torch to the other from one scene to the next. So they take on the attributes of the person that came before, and then it continues to grow and evolve. Take on those attributes, continues to grow and evolve. Like that.
So you hire, what, four people who look kind of the same or kind of similar build or something?
Sure, why not? Or completely different. Like, I don't know if it matters if they look the same, as long as that they can take on a similar physicality, whether it's the same walk, the same like gestures, things like that.
Oh, I understand it. Like they have a hunch or something.
Just so that way we're not limiting it to looks. I see you. You're a very cute hairy baby, but you need to stop. That's honestly, that would be something that I would be intrigued by. As far as fun facts from the opera, I would honestly tell people, I'm like, take a listen. There are some phenomenal, some of the best sopranos out there have sung this opera, some of whom worked their way through the characters depending on where they were in their professional development. So it's very interesting to see, kind of like how like a lot of Sondheim roles are out there, that you can grow and evolve into the characters and come back to it over and over again and be somebody else.
Is there a recording you would like to suggest to the audience?
Oh gosh. I would say, I mean, I love Natalie Dessay. She is a brilliant actress. She has an incredible voice. She's very gifted in that world. But like, what makes what she does so special is the acting, is her believability to every single character that she plays. And her Olympia is like the stuff of legends.
So obvious
one with Erin Morley at the Met. Erin Morley is also just, it's absurd the notes that she can hit, so.
As Olympia,
yes.
So, obviously, we had Ariana on, and she's said that she's working on the doll's big aria. Uh-huh. So, that's her role. In this, in a production the Life's But a Song production of Hoffman, who would you like to play?
I have worked my way through both Giulietta and Antonia, so I would be happy with either of those. If somebody were willing to say, Lauren, you know, because I think at this point, like, as much as I would love to be Niklaus, I also think that at this point in time, like, that should be an actual non-binary person playing Niklaus, well, whether it's a proper tenor or a mezzo, like, it should be played, and it should go in that direction. Because as much as I love the character, I'm also at a point in myself, personal, professional development of like, that is a space for somebody else.
Well, Lauren.
Antonia or Giulietta.
Well, Lauren, unfortunately, we have to get back into Stripe and Flat. But is there anything you'd like to plug and promote before we do that?
Same stuff, man. All things are good. You can catch me on the Bitch Please podcast with my darling, beloved co-host, Monique. This August's episode, we go in deep into politics about what's currently in the American political system. And oh boy, we had some fun recording our episode today.
Lauren, thank you for coming back on, for doing a special guest spot and talking a little bit more in depth about the opera. And everyone, let's get back into Sharp and Flat.
Bye, friends.
Sharp. Flat.
So in this segment, we're going to highlight some moments, whether or not we talked about it. If we liked it, it's sharp. And if we didn't like it or thought it could change, it's flat. Let's start with flats just so we can get it out of the way. So for me, my first flat is for my DVD not having the option for subtitles, because I can't hear without my subtitles these days.
Yes.
Because I am an elder millennial, everyone. I also flatted the five feathered fan. In the Olympia.
Kind of like, I thought when he came out with that, I thought that was going to be like a headpiece.
It just looked like not enough. It wasn't.
It was an like, odd choice.
Like everything in this movie is so like opulent and it's so grandiose. Granted, you know, it's not a lot. It's not like packed full of, you know, set deck or anything. Like it's a lot of wide open spaces, which was great. 'Cause I guess they were also again paying homage to the fact that it's an opera, and of course there's the dancing and everything, but everything was so grand and the makeup was so like intricate and you had costumes that were beautiful. And then you get to this fan and the fan is like prominent and it just looked like somehow the feathers just fell off. And that's why I'm flatting it. So I'm flatting Olympia's style, the cost, the design of it. I feel like we could have pushed it further, or they could have pushed it further. If this movie, if this was to be remade into a more recent movie, if they were to actually do another film version, I would love to like just see like big over the top, because like the rest of them were also over the top. So comparatively, they kind of toned her down. I get it. She's a dancer. So there's limitations for that. But like, we could have added like a bow or, like I said, porcelain like skin or something.
Yeah. I mean, I don't find it as flat and offensive as you do, but I see where you're coming from.
Yeah. It's not bad. I just had a higher expectation and it wasn't met. How about that? That's why it's a flat for me. 'Cause I'm like, this is the doll. She's a doll.
Right.
Make her a doll.
Right. And to kind of piggyback on that, I will say, you know, the conceit of the aria is that she winds down.
Yeah.
And has to be wound back up. And they did wind her back up, but very small. And, you know, they didn't have really like,
used
bring
the
out
palm of her hand too.
Yeah, and like I think down by her ankle at one point, they didn't bring out that, you know, like that big wind up
giant
key on her back. That was too subtle.
You know, it's really fascinating. This has nothing to do really with this scene, but it kind of reminded me. So I did a little brief lookup of E.T.A. Hoffman just to see what else he wrote, and he wrote the Nutcracker. Yeah. So I'm like, everything now makes sense. And then my last flat is for the terrible lip sync that sometimes they didn't do.
I mean, that's really my flat is the lip syncing, which is also not exactly a flat because it was amusing.
It's not the fact that they were dubbed. I'm okay with dubbing. You know, I understand this is the time period of dubbing. You know, actors aren't trying to prove that they are more than just actors. But it's the fact that they gave up in moments.
Yeah.
That's my
the fact that it just stopped. And like I said, it is a flat, but it's also just kind of funny, so it's not a flat.
Right. So
I found it amusing.
Which is a good segue, because every once in a while in this, I have what I like to call a natural, which is neither a sharp nor a flat. In this case, it's actually both. And it's the act change titles that happened that we talked about, where they open the book and they bring everything. I like it and I don't like it at the same time.
Right.
Because like I said, it felt like it halted the momentum of it being a movie. But it was also helpful to be like, this is what's going to happen this next scene, in case you can't understand a word they're saying. Like, here's Antonia. She has consumption. And then the next page, this is her mom. Nobody plays her.
She's dead.
She's dead. That was fun. Do you? Okay, let's get to sharps then. You want to go first with your sharps?
I'll go first. So, like, first big sharp is just Moira Shearer, because goddess, just stunning all around. The fact that they actually acknowledge the singers, because you know at that time there, there was this big hush hush. You know, you were not supposed to know that Marnie Nixon, you know, dubbed Deborah Carr and dubbed Natalie Wood and
dubbed everybody, basically
dubbed everybody. You know, it was like very hush hush, and like it was scandalous when it came out. So the fact that not only did they acknowledge them, but in the credits they give them a bow. They did that thing where it said singer actor, and they had them come out like and do a bow on the opera stage, and had them acknowledge each other in the bow. Like, that was a huge shock for me, you know, because I'm like, yeah, if you're going to dub, at least, you know, credit where credit's due,
because this is a fucking opera, so you can't be like, no, Marcia totally lip syncs,
totally
sang everything. Own
singing. She was singing high Fs, no big deal.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah.
Why didn't she lip sync half of it then?
I don't know. Yeah, well, on point and doing massive pirouettes.
Yes.
So that was like a huge shock for me. And just like the overall look of it
was beautiful. It was very consistent, which is good. I didn't sharp this, but I do love that the books were different.
Mm-hmm.
The interstitial books.
Yeah. And for me, those are sharp, the interstitials.
Okay.
Because it is an opera, and it might be something that people are put off of because it's an opera.
Right.
Giving you that little bit of information helps you stay in it for me.
Right, because it's like I understand what it is, because it's like you're looking at your program, because now you're coming back from intermission, the interval.
Right.
And you're like, okay, what's next?
Right. And I understand why you're kind of neutral it and kind of don't like it, but for me, I think it was a really good device,
yeah,
for them to use for the film. I like that, you know, as I said, they stayed pretty close to the opera. They didn't, you know, they didn't jump the shark and be like, oh, let's add this completely weird book scene in here that makes no real sense, but we're gonna do it because we're making a film,
you know?
So that was like definitely a solid sharp for me.
Any other sharps?
I think that's it. I think just like overall, this is one of the better done musical films of the period. Like as a whole piece.
Yeah.
You know?
I was a little more stupid and specific with mine. For some of them, for example, I sharped the weather vanes in the opening because they were, like, buckle up, kids. If you think this is weird, you're not ready. But also the fact that they turned in rhythm, that's why I sharped them. I sharped the eyewear. Hello. I also, this is how I wrote it. I sharped the insanity that is the human marionettes.
I liked those. Those were pretty cool.
I mean, they were fun, but like, I mean, also the fact that they looked insane.
Right.
Like, that's more of it. And like, they're moving around.
I like that last one getting stuck on the curtain as it was being pulled up.
I mean, before that happened, like literally right before that happened, I was like, are they going to fly any of these people? Like, mm-hmm. that's the whole thing. And then you just see him lift and you're like, okay, great. I was like, yes, and we did it.
And they moved throughout the scene with that kind of artificial marionette.
Yes. Motion, but because that puppet master throwing them in and out of the diorama or whatever we call it, I was hoping they would fly out.
Right.
I also sharped Julieta on the boat. Listen, I'm down for any woman in a power stance on a gondola.
On a boat.
On a boat that is moving. It is moving. Like, everything about it was amazing. You know, the stagecraft, her in the power stance, costume, like, amazing. Mm-hmm. And then my last sharp is for Ann Ayers and Robert Ronsville. Yeah. I agree with you with Moira Shearer, but I want to give it to the people who were actually like also doing the singing.
Completely.
In this opera?
Completely.
I want to give them more credit because, you know, they were cast for this role to sing this, and it was great. Would you add any of the songs to your life's playlist? Now, the weird thing is, like, I searched the internet to find actual titles, and I really couldn't find any, or at least English translated titles.
Right.
So Aaron and I did another, did the Ingmar Bergman magic flute where it was in Swedish. And so we were like, I don't know what these titles are. So I didn't want to do that again.
Yeah. No.
I think I would listen to this album. Would you listen to this soundtrack?
I would listen to this album, this soundtrack. Yeah, it's pretty solid.
It's a great recording.
Yeah, it's a pretty solid record. Like I said, there's no voices in there that you're like, oh, what happened there?
Right. And the fact that it's in English, it's whatever at this point. Like, I realized I didn't have subtitles and I was a little too deep into it, I was just like, we're just going to hear pretty noises.
Here we are.
We're just going to hear pretty notes, and I have no idea what they're going to say. Oh, man.
Context clues.
Yeah. I'm going to. Oh, you're dancing? Great. Okay.
Great. What? Fabulous.
Oh, you're in a dream sequence leading up to your death? Okay, fine. We're fine. I understand. But on that note, Ariana, we're done with the episode. What do you have to plug or promote?
I mean, right now we're looking at the All Stars thing over at Stonewall, and you know, other things that are just like up in the air. The best thing to do is just follow me on Instagram, which is Lady Aria with an underscore at the end. And you know, if I'm doing anything, it'll pop up there. If you want to hire me for something, Soprano, I mean, available. I need work.
She will get her ass finishing up the Dolls Aria.
I will. Like you give me a reason. Like, that's the other thing. It's always easier for me to learn something if I like have a deadline,
a goal. Yeah.
When it's just like, oh, I want to learn this because I should have this in my book or whatever. It's kind of like, oh, well, there's no real rush.
But now it's like, no, we got to do it.
But now it's like, no, we got to do it. So get your ass in gear. So, hey. Book me.
Is there like an Instagram page for the All Stars, or is it just the Stonewall Instagram page that they're doing?
It's just Anthony just like announces it on his Instagram, Anthony Fett.
And we got to get him on here at some point.
You should get him on.
Yeah, I really want him to come on here.
He's bar interesting.
I love Anthony Fett, so I need to get him on here. If anybody knows Anthony Fett,
and I know him.
I mean, I know him too. But if anyone can like push Anthony Fett to come onto this podcast, please let me know. You can email, you can give him my socials, which are email is at buttersongpod@gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Threads at buttersongpod. Were you, dear listener, in a production of The Tales of Hoffman, and who did you play? I would love to hear. I love hearing stories of like people in the in a show, and you know, we love to hear when things go wrong because we're a little catty like that. But yes, and if you want to be part of the next episode's conversation, well, we're still going on with John's picks, and let me tell you, we're going all over the place because the next day. The next episode, we're doing The Chipmunk Adventure, which I am so excited. So, buckle up, kiddos. Ariana, thank you so much for coming back on.
You're welcome. Thank you for letting me
redeem myself.
Yes, this was a much better pick.
I'm not going to lie, though. I picked this blindly as well. So I was like 50-50 shot right now. We're going for broke.
It worked.
And thank you everyone for listening, and bye for now.
Special thanks to Aaron Troy for creating the pod's artwork, and to Nick Bombacino for composing the theme song and the jingles. A huge thank you to CastBox for hosting this podcast, and thank you again for tuning in to today's episode of Life's But a Song. Bye for now, everyone, and have a musical day.